Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Detraction Pieces Podcast, episode 254. And I'm joined this week by Lolly Adefope. I'm in bed ill at the moment. I'm a little bit bunged up, a little bit sniffly. So apologies if my voice in the intro and outro is a bit of a mess. But I'll do my best to sound nice for you lovely lot. How you all doing, guys? Hell of a week last week on the podcast. Good God. Mary J. Blige and Joe Cornish in the same week. The reaction to both has been frankly ridiculous. So thank you so much for that. It's been nuts. And we launched the digital version of Pod Bible last week, which again, the reaction has been absolutely insane. Go and check out the Pod Bible social medias if you've missed it all. It's a free magazine that's all about podcasts and recommending and stuff like that, and interviews with Adam Buxton and Craig Parkinson of Two Shot Pod, all sorts of stuff like that. So yeah, it's well worth having a look. It's all free, so go and check all of that out. This is a bit of a broken up intro because I'm a bit phased. Things I have to tell you about. There's an episode that's out in a few weeks I need to tell you about, which is really exciting. But before I get to that, I've recorded a load of things called the Distraction Pieces Rewind episodes. Essentially, in each episode, I sit down for, it could be 20 minutes. I think most of them are around 30, 40, 50 minutes at the moment. And I basically go over previous episodes five at a time. So I'm starting at the beginning. Cause like, I could talk about behind the scenes stuff, kind of how it was all organised, often how I met the guest, like how I first got to know them, anything like that. The first five episodes I'm talking about are with Russell Brand, Zane Lowe, Alan Moore, DJ Yoda and Sage Francis. And yeah, I've been really enjoying recording them and having a bit of a stroll down memory lane and remembering, as said, stuff that happened around the time of recording, but then also any real highlights that jump out from the episode and anything I learned, anything I think went well or I think went wrong, all sorts of stuff like that. They're fascinating. And I'm putting them out every third Monday of the month. So the first one came out this Monday over at patreon.com/scroobiouspip. And it's still $1 a month. I'm not doing any of these tiers where you get audio if you pay $5 or $10 or whatever else. Everything over there is $1 a month. You get Poem of the Month and now Distraction Pieces Rewind every month. You get preview photos every time I record a podcast, so you get to know the upcoming guests in advance. And that actually leads nicely on to what I was going to say about an upcoming guest, because the biggest reaction I've had all year is to a podcast I recorded the other week and I posted about, and it's had the most likes on my Patreon, the most likes and comments. It's been pure hype over there, and it's coming out in 3 weeks' time. I've got two huge names in the next couple of weeks. I'll keep them a secret. And I said, I normally only announce upcoming guests over at Patreon, but this one's a big one and I want to pre-hype it and get you ready for it, because it's not a celebrity. It's a guy called PC Leon McLeod, and he was one of the first three officers to be on scene in the London Bridge attack, or the Tower Bridge. Sorry, it's not London Bridge, is it? It's the Tower Bridge terrorist attack. And he's got Medal of the Queen for it and stuff like that. But the reason he was brought to my attention was to commemorate it. He got a tattoo of one of my lyrics, and that blew my mind. So, you know, I'd got in touch, and then he came down to my club night, and we met and chatted a bit. And I asked if he'd be up for coming on the podcast. I didn't want to put any pressure on it. And he was incredibly cautious. Again, I will explain all the reasons he was cautious for coming on. But he decided he did want to, and we recorded an episode, and it's amazing. It's really, it's, yeah, it's something else. his openness and his honesty about all of it. And the changes it's had on his life, the changes he feels are his own fault, the errors he thinks he's made. It's a hell of a conversation, and I wanted to kind of pre-hype it. I'm going to probably keep pre-hyping it in the 3 weeks leading to it dropping, because I want you all, you know, it is often, if it isn't a big name, people will skip it or move on or not pay attention. And this is one that really deserves a lot of attention. So, I'm starting the hype now. The hype will continue until it comes out in March. But as I said, I've got two great ones before that the Patreon gang would know about. But, I'm recorded all the way up until, like, April at the moment. And I'm recording two or three more this week. I've lined up a crazy one that's kind of a variation on the Drunk Cast, but quite different. It's with two of my favourite comedians, and it's going to get messy, but I'll explain that another time as well. And let's get on with the podcast. I'll mention, as ever, that we're brought to you by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. I'd love it if you go over there and have a look around the web store. You don't even have to buy anything. Just go and have a bit of a browse. If you go over there and look, you'll see I put an insane, almost uncomfortable amount of time into making unusual and creative merch, let's say. There's some weird stuff. I've done swimwear, mate. I've done all sorts of odd things. So go and have a look around there. And if anything jumps out, then have a little purchase, maybe. No harm in that, eh? No bloody harm in that. Anyway, I don't think I've got tons I need to tell you about. And as I said, I'm in bed sick at the moment. So I'm going to record this and send it off to Buddy Peace. And then he can pop it on. And you've got a lovely intro and outro to listen to on a great podcast. It was amazing to talk to Lolly. It was the first time we'd met. And she was an absolute delight. Pure joy. I then, a week or two later, I went and watched her on Brett Goldstein's live Films to Be Buried With podcast. And again, just absolutely in awe of this young lady. The moves that she's making are fantastic. And she truly seems like one of the good guys in this game. So I hope you enjoy this. I do ask an uncomfortable amount of questions about Harry Potter. Obviously, I'm not actually asking about Harry Potter. I'm asking about Daniel Radcliffe, who she worked with on a show in America. But I think I always refer to him as Harry Potter, so there's that. Hope you enjoyed this. I'll be back at the end. We have a little bit of information about other stuff. But until then, this is episode 254 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Lolly Adefope. Movies,
yes,
and I like sweets with movies,
yeah.
So I buy a lot of sweets to go on the plane with and just sit there,
same,
pigging out, not eating any real food for the whole flight. I had the year before, I was back and forth from LA three times, I think, in the year, all for castings and stuff like that. And just to go in, I'm kind of a fan of it's just how I've been brought up, but I'm a fan of just going and meeting people face to face. So, soon as I started acting, I was like, ask my agent, can you get me some meetings out there that aren't for a role that I can just go and say, hello,
yeah,
I'm 6'4" and I've got a big beard. It's quite weird. It's not going to fit everything.
But So I did a
load of that, and it was just, half of it was, I got so many good films watched.
Yeah,
I got so much.
It's great. So much TV.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, again, always have the illusion I'm going to read, I'm going to get writing done, I'm going to do all the productive.
I take five books. Yeah. I don't touch them.
Not at all. And I'll have them in my little Airbnb as well. But it's like, I've got American Netflix now.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm only on this for a week. I need to make the most of
all the not
series.
Yeah.
No, are we all... How are we doing? Are we good to go? Yes, I'll start. I'm joined today by Lolly Adefope. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good.
We've not met before, but we've chatted for a while about you coming on, mm-hmm. and I'm a fan of your work, and kind of particularly when it's new guests, the tip is always you have to make them relaxed and comfortable. Mm. And I'm going to go the other route with that, because on my way in this morning, I noticed my notes for the podcast mm-hmm. were last edited at 4:49 last night.
Okay.
Without any real memory of that. And it
wow.
turns out... you were in my dream last
no
night.
No way.
And I made a note of it. And it's not as creepy as it sounds, but it just cracked me up. That I was like, flattered. What's this? So you were being told off by Noel Gallagher for not washing your hands
that
after
was no
coming
dream.
Back from the bathroom. And then we sat down and watched that new Netflix documentary about the fire festival, which I've not watched yet.
I mean,
it looks amazing.
This is pretty close to reality. So, this is not that far.
Just quite a weird... It felt like we've already met just before,
before
we actually met, because I had that strange interaction.
Have you seen that documentary?
I haven't. Have you watched it yet?
I've seen it, yeah.
Is it amazing?
It's pretty amazing.
Because I remember just watching it unfold on social media.
Yeah,
the
weirdness...
It's weird, because it was an event... I guess it's one of the first events that almost purely unfolded on social media, because most news events you can then turn on the news and it's all happening
exactly,
there.
Yeah,
but that
yeah.
was one that it literally was contained there at least for the day that it was.
Because the root of the festival
happening.
Was social media as well, I guess.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah, it's the documentary is like you think that it can't get more shocking, and then something extremely shocking happens.
Well, that was the beautiful part, was I saw the documentary come up and I thought, I don't remember that story that clearly, so I'm not going to research it. That's the best way to go into
exactly.
it, right? At first of all, I'll Google to remember what it was.
No,
don't. Just...
Yeah, they all show you everything in the documentary, I think the one thing about that whole thing is that normally with stuff like that, you kind of feel sorry for someone in that kind of experience.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, because the victims are like rich, like annoying young people who have paid like $5,000.
And their reactions were wonderfully dramatic seemed, so.
No spoilers, but there is like someone who sues them, and I was kind of like, well, I mean, you have a lot of money.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What trauma have you really experienced?
Exactly. You're just having a dig here.
Yeah, exactly. It's
bizarre. Well, I mean, let's start by talking a little bit about social media, because when we were last arranging this, things had blown up a bit on social media, and there was it cracked me up. And as I assume it wasn't actually a stressful situation for you, because it was.
It was
so,
quite stressful. Yeah,
did it get quite stressful? Because it was such an overreaction to such a small comment. I believe anyone should be able to criticize or flag something,
mm-hmm.
and particularly as a comedian, you're allowed
exactly.
to joke about it.
So.
Very briefly, you retweeted a post about a charity gig mm-hmm. and said that someone's hoping for a very white Christmas.
Yeah, it was a charity gig.
The entire cast was white.
Yeah.
Or everyone, all the comedians.
Yeah, it was all
white
comedians. It was 19, I think, male white comedians and five female comedians. And it was a charity gig where comedians were going to be singing Christmas songs, basically.
Yeah.
So I was like... Just did a very clever pun.
And
I tweeted someone's dreaming of a white Christmas.
And quite a throwaway thing. But I guess it's also the reason a lot of podcasts close down over Christmas is it's hard to make much content at that time.
Yeah.
So I think news-wise it's hard. So it got then blown out of proportion and was kind of, it was a Twitter moment mm-hmm. within moments.
Yeah.
And then that draws in the people... who just want to get angry about stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I recorded a podcast with a Johan Harry recently, who I think it'll be coming out after this, but he was saying when you release a book, you also have to deal with the ghost version of your book that becomes targeted by people who haven't read it online.
So
there's a version that they imagine, they've seen one quote and they imagine what you're saying.
Yeah.
They've not read it, but they're angry about it. And it felt like that with this. There was then all of these attacks of the deep... hurt you had and the deep attack you made on this thing, when you're like, I just made a joke and pointed out a valid point.
Yeah, I think it was like people imagined that I had seen a charity gig and ignored the fact that it was for charity and said, I hate this gig and nobody should give money to charity and nobody should go to this gig and nobody should support comedy unless it's got equal numbers of black people and white people.
Yeah.
And I mean, if I had said that, fair enough to be like a bit annoyed at me, but it was just a joke, and it was like, I feel like if, you know, Frankie Boyle had made that joke, or any other slightly controversial male comedian had made that joke,
yeah,
it would have been taken as a joke, and it would never have been taken as like, this person's very angry and this person is raging, or like slamming Harry Hill or anyone who was involved in it.
Yeah, and it was such a, as I said, it was a, it worries me that people feel that the involvement of charity makes things unable to be questioned.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And again, there's nothing wrong with that. It's, again, it would be different if you were saying this is a disgrace.
Yeah.
But you kind of just highlighted, look, this isn't necessarily how things should be. And it's, I think it's a problem that social media, I don't think it invented, but I think it's certainly amplified because all of our opinions are so logged.
Yeah.
And therefore we become so defensive of them rather than, all right, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe I was wrong then. It's something that comedians and musicians have to deal with their whole lives, because you'll make a joke when you're younger.
Yeah.
That'll be on record somewhere.
Exactly.
And your opinion, you'd hope, you'll change as a person, you'll develop. So there's going to be stuff that I've said in lyrics that I don't particularly believe anymore or live by. Well, you said that. So. Yeah, no, I said that.
Yeah, well, everyone changes their mind all the time.
But that's kind of become the thing on social media now. Mm-hmm. People get incredibly defensive of any viewer opinion rather than, well, let's have a discussion about it. I'm not saying it's the devil, but I'm not saying it's okay either. It's, again, it's a talk about nuance a lot on the podcast. It's a similar thing. I'm not saying it's Harvey Weinstein, but maybe it's Louis C.K. Or maybe you know, because there are scales. All these things do get put as one thing. So Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, Louis C.K., even Aziz Ansari will all get bunched into one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's huge variation there.
Yeah,
and to say that isn't justifying any of them or excusing any of them, but it's saying they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
So you flagging something.
I know.
Saying, look at this. This is a bit weird.
Yeah, just being like, ha, 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 look at this. It's just, completely blown out of proportion.
But you'd hope that, and again, a few of the comedians involved, who are comedians, you know, I like as well, got defensive of it and stuff like that, but you'd hope that people can just take that on board a little bit.
Yeah, I think most of the comedians were quite understanding when they saw the poster, because they obviously just agreed to do a gig for charity,
of course,
as you would.
Yeah. No one stipulated. Oh,
This is what the poster's
going to
be.
White people.
Yeah, exactly. But
as far as we know.
But one of the comedians on the bill sort of just took umbrage with my tweet for some reason, which I think was kind of ignited a lot of the attention.
It kicked it all off a lot more and brought, again, the thing that it's weird because it's now as if I'm using this to plug my Patreon. But I started a Patreon page and I wasn't into the whole Patreon idea of things. I started one that's the only thing you can pledge is a dollar. And my vow was you don't get anything for that dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be just, if you've got a spare dollar, that's it. I don't want any pressure. I don't want to have to perform for you or dance or sing or ring you up.
Mm-hmm.
but what I found I loved about Patreon as I started to use it was it's a closed social media.
Mm.
So you've not got the onlooking eyes of those who don't understand your point of view or perspective.
Yeah.
I will post stuff that people don't agree with, but we'll have a reasoned discussion because we're starting from a point of, we're all reasonable people, or we assume we're all reasonable people. Let's discuss it. Whereas on Twitter and Facebook, as the two in particular, I think kind of less so on Instagram because it's harder to share.
Yeah, it's not really
images.
About saying stuff.
So, it's kind of on those two, you will, as soon as you get out of your circle of reference or of followers, there's all these people who don't know who you are and are just going, here's what I've decided.
Yeah, exactly.
It gets ugly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all, you know, that's blown over, thankfully, and we can move on. So I normally start at the beginning of a career or of a life, but I kind of want to start in the present at the moment, because you're working on some amazing and exciting stuff and you're working in America a lot, which is a really hard thing to pull off and to make happen. So what's been going on recently and what are you working on, and what was your kind of route into making it click out there? Because it feels like it clicked and then more and more comes from that, because you're in those circles and you meet the, impress the right people, I guess.
It's hard to say what made it click. I guess I got my American agent.
Yeah.
And then I went to New York just to have meetings and things. And then I went to a read through for a show called Miracle Workers.
Yes.
And then got cast in that show. So I think maybe that was
with
the start.
Daniel Radcliffe and Steve Buscemi, which mm-hmm. is
yeah.
that's fantastic, the tallest guys right? in the world.
Yeah.
yeah.
And last year, or the year before last year, I did a film called The Spy Who Dumped Me.
Yes.
Which was actually just an audition that I just did in London on a Saturday. And I was
oh, wow.
like,
that's
yeah.
cool.
My agent sent it to me and I was like, why am I going to this audition on a Saturday? I'm not going to get this part in a film.
Yeah.
Like, there's no point. But just went anyway, obviously.
They're good fun, them ones.
Yeah.
Right? Because almost the pressure is off. Like,
yeah,
I genuinely,
yeah.
I seem to be one of the few people who enjoy auditions, but those ones in particular where you're like, well, number one, I'm not going to get it. And
yeah.
number two, I don't care that much. I don't know what this is. But like, if it's not a known franchise, you're kind of like, eh.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, I think when I was walking out, I bumped into someone that I knew who was is much more famous than me. And I was like, well,
yeah.
there's no stressing about
me,
what
I,
this is.
I had an audition once and I bumped into, I'll call him Angelos. As that's, I bumped into Dan afterwards or beforehand. And we had a quick chat and a catch up. And then I went and did the audition. And it wasn't until the film came out that I realised we were both going for this because
right,
I bumped into
right,
him in the
right.
street
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
then I, the film started to come out and I saw he'd been cast in the role
right,
I'd gone for.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
when did I last see him?
Yeah.
That's what was, I'm so slow on these things. Yeah. I had no kind of, I didn't
I
link
to be
it
like,
together.
I used to be really obsessed with if I didn't get a part in something that I really wanted, I used to be really like obsessed with finding out who then got the part and watching it and seeing
Have
what they
did.
Have
you got any people that is your specific that tends to get the roles? I've got two. That have happened more than once.
I think there's like a couple of people who we go up for the same stuff a lot.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of a mixture of who gets what, I think. But it's interesting because we're quite different.
Well, similar. I had two different ones that I really wanted to get.
Mm.
And Carl Urban got them both.
Who's that?
He played Dredd in Judge Dredd. He's done tons of good stuff, but he's huge. Mm. And it's it's nice when it's one like that because you're like, oh, that's mad I was even considered.
Yeah,
I had another one recently that I really wanted, and it had to be a self-tape because it was an American thing. I really went all in on it.
Mm.
And then the guy who got cast is flipping Aquaman. I'm like, how can I compare to that?
That's
amazing.
Cool,
I've got a beard, but, you know, and I had longer hair at the time. But again, it was, yeah, it's finding the right outlook on those things,
I
guess. It probably more annoying if it is someone who you're like, that's like at the same level as
yeah,
me.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's kind of, what did I do wrong, rather than... Because I can go, well, it's Aquaman, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
They shouldn't have even looked at my tape.
No, they shouldn't.
So how was The Spy Who Dumped Me? Because that's with two of the world's sexiest humans, in Justin Theroux and Mila Kunis, both amazing. How was that to be part of?
It was amazing. It was my first film, and it was shot in Budapest, which was very cool.
Wow.
Yeah, I've never been to Budapest before.
How
I think they shot in lots of different locations. I was out there for 2 weeks, but two separate weeks.
Yeah.
And just in the summer, just by myself in Budapest, having a lovely time.
That's amazing, isn't
it? It was great, yeah.
Yeah, again, it's that mad thing of, I was listening to the Two Shot podcast a recent with Craig Parkinson, and he was talking to Jodie Whittaker, I think it was, about how acting can take you to places that you would never go. And it's weird. My experience of music is it takes you all around the world, but you have no time to see anything.
Right, yeah.
Whereas acting is a lot
so
of
much
waiting.
Time.
There's
yeah.
so much
yeah.
kind of, we don't need you today.
Yeah.
Right, I've just got a day
exactly.
to feel. So
yeah.
it is kind of amazing.
Yeah, because I'm never the kind of person who's like, okay, I'm going to go solo travelling.
Yeah.
And then I was in Budapest, and I think I was there for a week, but I wasn't filming for the whole week.
Yeah.
And I finished filming on, like, the Friday morning, and my flight was, like, on the Saturday night. And I just happened to have tweeted, how do I watch Love Island in Budapest? Because it was when I was addicted to Love Island. And two of my friends tweeted back to me that they were also in Budapest.
Oh, wow.
And then, so I hung out with them, went for a drink with them, and then they were like, oh, what are you doing this weekend? And I was like, oh, I'm leaving on Saturday. And they were like, well, we're staying with our friends, who they were also filming something else. And they'd rented this huge villa, because they basically all had the weekend off.
Wow. Yeah.
So they rented this, like, 20-person villa in Budapest, and they were like, well, you should just come. And I was free because I'd finished on Friday morning. So just went for Friday night and Saturday day to this incredible villa where I was like sometimes I go to houses and I'm like, okay, this is a beautiful house, but I wonder what a millionaire would think of this house.
completely.
And then I went to this villa and I was like, if I was a millionaire, I would think that this was the most beautiful villa I've ever seen.
I wonder what a billionaire would think of this house.
Yeah, exactly. Even then I was like, this is objectively amazing. And it was just, it was sort of like a dream. It was like this massive sort of terracy thing from which you could jump into the pool.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, yeah, it was just mad.
I love it. And I love that because it seems crazy that you'd know people there at the time, but it's something I've noticed because of the industries that we're in, with comedy and acting, you do end up knowing a lot of people who end up in weird as fuck places.
Yeah.
I had it in New York once. I was out there for some meetings and I had a podcast that cancelled in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked and one of my best mates, who's an actor I'd worked with, had just done a selfie, honestly, 5 minutes up the road from me. So I literally texted him and go,
yeah,
I'll walk to you now. It's amazing.
Yeah,
you've got to
love
that. It's, again, I guess that's one of the benefits of social media as well.
I'd never have known.
We maybe wouldn't have known,
And the benefits of Love Island as well.
Yeah, huge benefits of Love Island. You did that. And how was it on Miracle Workers? Where did that film?
That was in Atlanta.
In Atlanta? Mm. Oh, man.
Yeah, but it was very cold.
I've always wanted to go to Atlanta. I love, again, it's one of the few places I've not got to tour, but...
Mm.
I've worked with the De La Soul guys and they're all in Atlanta. I've worked, or had Killer Mike on the podcast and done some shows with his Atlanta, Donald Glover, who I've
so
never
many
met,
cool
but
people.
Obviously I'm obsessed with every sensible person.
The coolest
person
guy
is.
In the world, yeah.
So it just feels like there's so much in Atlanta that's just...
Yeah.
And my mate Barry, who's not famous, but I feel rude mentioning Atlanta and not mentioning him, because if he listens, he'll be like, all right, so you want to come to Atlanta to see me, yeah? That's what you tell me, but yeah. So how was that? And how long were you out there for? Because TV can be a slow and long process.
It was 2 months I was there.
Wow.
Over Christmas. I came home for Christmas in between.
Mm.
And it was great, because most of the cast... I guess Steve Shermie's like a bit older and he would go back to New York sometimes.
Yeah.
But we were kind of all the same age
and
just kind of had the same sense of humour and got on really well. And the show was really fun and really funny. And just like, obviously just so cool to be a part of.
What's Harry Potter like?
He's so nice. Yeah.
Years ago, in a Q magazine thing, he picked one of my songs. It was when I only had like two songs. He picked one of my songs as one of his, or he referenced it or quoted it or something. And I was like, I've never met him, never had any interaction with him since, but it's always been like, I need to find out what Harry Potter's actually like. So
he's the nicest person in the world.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say too nice, but he is unbelievably nice.
Yeah. And for someone who kind of said was thrown into huge stardom at a really young age. Mm-hmm. So, it's certainly an interesting one.
Mm, yeah, quite a mad life, I think.
So what's Miracle Workers about?
That's Miracle Workers is set in heaven.
Yes.
And it's about God is like the CEO of Heaven Inc., which is the company that runs heaven, and that runs the earth, sorry. And basically God decides that the earth is doomed and everything's going wrong and it's not the amazing earth that he wanted it to be. So he's like, I'm going to destroy the earth. And two of the people who work at Heaven Inc., Daniel Radcliffe and Geraldine Viswanathan, they decide to conspire together to save the earth.
Right.
Basically, because they're like, no, you can't give up on this planet. Like, there's still hope, basically.
And is your character pro or anti the earth? In the show and in real life, which I'll ask those two questions separately.
In the show, I think I start off quite anti-Earth, but who knows what happens as the show goes on.
And in real life?
And in real life, so pro-Earth.
Good.
Guys, we're ruining the Earth.
It's easy to be anti, or more anti-humans at
the
moment,
exactly.
The
Earth hasn't done anything wrong.
So how was that to jump into that? Because you've done a load of different TV shows and stuff in the past. I want to talk about Rovers later, because I love that and I love all those guys.
Mm.
But all UK-based, and it's a different feeling when you're out there, right? Because it's not a good thing, but living in the UK and growing up in the UK, it's America.
Mm.
That's where they make entertainment.
Exactly,
that's where entertainment comes from. So it does feel like... My brief experience of doing castings or whatever over there, it feels like I'm in Hollywood
or whatever,
because you are. But, you know, it's that weird. So how was that, to be part of that?
Yeah, it was
was it intimidating to jump onto that?
I think a little bit. Well, the first time I walked onto the set, it was like the first time I'd ever seen like a big American studio.
Yeah.
So that felt very cool. And even just like little things like the chairs that say your name on and stuff.
It's exactly like in films. A lot of the castings in LA are in Universal or in these actual places. So
yeah.
I've gone thinking I'm going to be going to a block of flats somewhere, yeah, as in the UK where most of the castings are, and I get there and they literally drop me at the gates of Universal Studios.
Yeah.
And
like, it's mad.
This is exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think definitely much more exciting to come from London and go to America rather than to already be from America and then just be like, well, this is what I'm used to.
Yeah.
And also, like, the craft services are very
That's
cool.
That's what everyone talks about. Great. Yes. I think it's genuinely why a lot of British people are making more and more of an impact in America now, because particularly in LA, I've spoken to a few people who are like, that's one of the jobs that you're always thought of as a kid, because you're in...
You're there already.
Be an actor, I might do this, or maybe I'll go and do that. Whereas in the UK, it's not so much. And particularly to break into American cinema or TV, it feels unimaginable. So when you get there, you're chomping at the bit.
Yeah,
right?
I think we're definitely like hungrier for it. Yeah. Also, because it's quite weird to like live in a city that is show business, I think. It's just, just quite an odd experience.
Yeah.
Because even when I go to LA, I'm kind of like, it's so weird to just constantly be surrounded by actors and producers and stuff.
I love visiting. I don't know if I could live there.
No, I don't think I could live there.
You visit, you get to go, this is mad. I literally just walked past Tom Hanks or
it's
something
too
like
much.
That. It's like, it's mind-blowing.
I don't think I would live there.
Yeah, because I think it would take away a bit of the excitement and magic that I want to keep in my career
exactly.
in this industry. I
don't
want to become numb to that kind of excitement.
And also, I don't want my day-to-day life to be just constantly thinking about acting and constantly thinking about like scripts and stuff. You want like a grounding of like, okay, I've got a nice home and nice friends and a nice normal life.
Yeah.
And then my job is what I do like some of the time.
Yeah.
And then,
completely. So tell the listeners a little bit about craft services, because I've only heard, heard tales of this amazing, the difference between the British kind of catering on a movie gig. But craft services, it's legendary, right?
I guess, I mean, on a huge film, it's probably even better, which I've never experienced. But just in general, I mean, it's bad because it's you just eat all the time. But
you can eat anything.
There's basically like... Well, the show that I did last year was a show called Shrill, which is important.
Luca Jones, who's, I love. He's a mate of mine. I met him through a friend on my first trips to LA, and it was weird because, as you will have known from going to anything in LA or whatever, if you go out for dinner, it's often a bit, well, here's a movie exec.
And
I'm never comfortable in those situations. Yeah. And me and Luca just paired up in one of those meals where everyone's a bit, I'm now working on this. We were the two kind of hairy guys in the corner going like, oh, this is nuts.
This is weird,
But yeah, so on that, yeah.
So that one there was just a table that's just permanently, you know, rooted by the set, which was all of the snacks you want, all of the, like, M&Ms and just, you know, cereal bars galore.
It's
great.
Yeah.
And then there was also a van where you could, like, make sandwiches and stuff, which I never actually did because, I mean, it's a lot of effort to be like, okay, I'm going to go make myself a sandwich when there's lunch in an hour. It was that.
I'm going to have a mid-lunch sandwich. It is dangerous on set because, again, if you're not the lead or if you're not the first three or four people on the call sheet, you are going to be sitting around a lot. Easy to go, I'm not even that hungry, but
I'm bored.
I'm going to fill my time is there's a big sandwich truck there with all the food I've ever imagined.
Exactly.
And it's got like the whip stuff that you only see in American films. So I'm just going to kill my time by eating everything.
I get confused between whether I'm bored or whether I'm hungry.
Or
thirsty.
It's a brutal one. So, so that was kind of three projects kind of in a row, right? They're all in the last year or so.
The Spy Who Dumped Me was summer 2017.
Yeah.
And then Miracle Workers was December to February 17 to 18.
Yeah.
And then Shrill was last summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's kind of, and again, this feels like an end of the interview question, but what's the plan going forward? Because there's weird things in America with Brits will often go and stay out there for 3 months to have meetings and all that. And for me, that I get it, but it also feels like you're setting yourself up to be in pain and misery.
Yeah.
Because you're going, I'm going to go and wait.
Yeah, exactly.
And see if I hear anything.
Can't
so
have that.
Are you kind of consciously focusing more time in America, or do you have that advantage of we live in the modern world. You've got an American agent. So mm-hmm. you can continue doing whatever in the UK.
Yeah.
And then if you need to go there, you're kind of...
Yeah, I think at the moment I'm very happy in London.
Yeah.
And I like the comedy scene in London. Yeah. And there's lots of, not as much, but lots of cool stuff being made in the UK as well. Yeah. So I like to sort of go to America sometimes and do cool stuff rather than, I mean, it's like up to anyone, but I don't really want to be in America, like you said, waiting for someone to give me an opportunity. I'd rather like be with my friends.
It feels
my family.
Really weird. I mean, I was told my uncomfortableness with that paid off on my trips to America because I would be, I'm here for a week. If
yeah,
you'd like to
yeah.
meet me.
Yeah, exactly.
See me. Whereas if you say I'm here for 3 months, it will be.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll try and sell something next week.
Yeah,
oh, we'll
exactly.
have to move that. Whereas
yeah.
I guess if you are there just going, look, I'm here for a week.
Yeah, yeah. Like I've got my own stuff going on. If you're interested, then great. If not, then no worries.
And it's a better way to resist the pitfalls psychologically of that industry.
Yeah, I think
it is the one that I think people... the reason you hear of a lot of actors getting either bitter or low or self-conscious is because it is that weird... It's a cliche to say it is the hurry up and wait thing.
We
need you here at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
Be
just
here
sit by
and
the phone,
hang about, and
yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
So,
not for me.
I mean, I'm going to continue on the acting front and then get round to comedy tools at the end because it's weird because I would generally have if I'd not sat down and thought, I would have thought I think of Lolly as a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much great acting stuff that is it a tough thing to balance or do you have to consciously choose which?
I think I'm the kind of person who's very critical of anyone who says that they're a comedian and doesn't gig and doesn't like do the stuff that you need to do to be a comedian. And so then I'm also slightly self-conscious about the fact that at the moment I'm sort of doing more acting than comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the moments when I'm not filming something, I try to book gigs in and like try and write some new material. So I've got some like shows coming up where I'm like trying to challenge myself more because I think comedy is just so much harder and it's much more rewarding. Not that acting is like not that I hate acting, it just feels so like nice a lot of the time. It just feels like you're getting driven around and people are sort of telling you what to do, which in a way
it's
is
kind
just
of
quite
a nice.
It's quite passive.
I think they really they're kind of countering art forms in many ways because in acting you have the relief of kind of handing in your homework and leaving.
Yeah, exactly.
If you know
what I mean, you
get to do your
you do
thing,
that so
but
early
it's in
on.
Someone else's hands in the end. And there's so many components, whereas stand-up is the exact opposite.
Yeah.
There's no components other than you.
Exactly.
You're up there on your own.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's nice to have those two to make you appreciate each of them.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
If the
pressure of stand-up is breaking you, then you've got that, well, at least I don't have to have that. At least I can go and act and focus. I'll focus completely on my art and on the art form of it, but I don't have that pressure of
everything's
of planning everything out and where it needs to be and everything's on me. It's like I need to learn my shit, do my shit, and then the rest is on.
Yeah, so it's quite nice to find the balance of it. Yeah. I think sometimes with acting, I remember I was doing something once where we were filming something where it was like a lot of people sat around a table for like quite a long scene. So most of the day was just us sat around this table and they were like putting the cameras in the right place and everything, and I was eating a banana and then they were like, okay, we're going to start filming now, and then someone came to take my banana skin and I was like, I can't live my life like this where I'm giving you my banana skin. But then they were like, no, because you need to be in the right position and like, can you not move your chair and all that kind of stuff, and I was like, I'm really sorry, like this is not going to work. So that kind of stuff kind of makes me have a like moment of, okay, what's going on here?
Is this what
I want?
on the first film I did, it was filmed at Warner Brothers, so we were past the Harry Potter studios all the time, so it increased my curiosity of Daniel Radcliffe. But they would be spinning out because they'd always try and arrange my car, and I'd be like, I'll just drive myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a car. It's really, you know, I'm really punctual.
Yeah.
But they don't...
But so many people aren't.
It fills them with fear.
Yeah.
So
I've worked with people before.
It took me a good
so
week
late.
Or two for them to just accept that I'll... Tell me when you need me to be there.
Yeah.
I'll be there early. I'm always here early. I'm annoying about that. So... But yeah, it's exactly that. It's that kind of... And when we were doing... I was doing a thing for the BBC. The set was literally a 10-minute drive from my house.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I can't have you... There's a guy that's going into London to get people going all over the place. It's like, don't worry about me.
Yeah,
get it. I could get the train if I needed to. Yeah. It's that easy. So
yeah, and it's, yeah, it just sort of grounds you. It makes you not think, like, because there have been times when, because people are so nice to actors when you're on set, and they're sort of like, oh, like, this person's coming through, like, make way and stuff, and it's just almost like quite unnerving. Yeah. And then I've had moments where I'm doing comedy and I sort of forget that that is not how you get treated when you're doing comedy.
100%.
And I have to, you have to sort of like keep switching from two different modes, I think.
Yeah.
So I have to try and get like a middle ground for both, I think, where I'm like, okay, no, I'm fine. Yeah. I can look after myself, but thank you so much for everything.
I've been on the tube before, and I wish that there was someone shouting travelling.
Exactly.
And clearing a path for me when it's got hectic.
Yeah, like, you really have to check yourself to be like, okay, no, they don't have to get out of my way.
But equally, it's anything that is that you adapt to your surroundings naturally, because in reality, it's helpful for the production for you to let that person take that, that banana skin.
Yeah. You're actually more difficult if you're like, no, I'm going to move my chair.
So it is that weird thing. You then have to switch. I was shooting a film in France, and then I had to do a pickup of a thing I'd shot previously in England.
Mm-hmm.
And in the makeup, I just kept saying mercy to everyone, because I don't know any French, but I'd, painfully polite. I'd have that in my head, and a few different short phrases that I'd then be saying it to some bloke from Leeds, and I'd be like, oh, I feel like such a prick. But it's because it's that habit for you, trying to adapt to your surroundings, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that me and Brett Goldstein, actually, a mutual friend, have talked about in recent years is that there's often a natural kind of push to focus, for Brits to focus on breaking America, when in recent years there's so much good stuff being made in England and Europe. And we can't decide if we've decided to focus on that because we've failed miserably in America or if it is a genuine conscious decision. But there is so much good stuff being made. And one of the things in recent years, or last year, in fact, that blew me away was Stafflet's Flats.
Oh, yeah, which
we were involved in and part of. And how is it to get gigs like that? Because I assume a lot of the people involved in that are your mates, right?
Yeah.
Are people you know. So it's a different... Again, it's a different excitement altogether. Mm-hmm. It's in ways it's more exciting because you and your mates are all making you're helping your mates bring their vision to life.
Yeah, exactly.
But equally, on an American one, it feels proper and grown up.
Yeah, yeah.
So how was that to work?
I think that kind of thing's very cool, especially because Jamie made it as a blap first, and so to see it go from a blap that maybe not as many people have watched, and then a show that so many people are watching, it's quite cool to be like, okay, actually, even though this is your friend's very niche, cool sense of humour, actually it's very like appealing to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So it's quite exciting, I guess, because a lot of the time, I think when you first start doing comedy and you're getting like a lot of rejection or like gigs aren't going well and stuff, you start to think that what you're making is so niche that only your friends will understand
it. It's actually not fun. And it must be tough for Jamie as well, because so much... It's Jamie and his sister who find it hilarious. It's like, is it only us two?
Not even
that it's me and my friends. It's me and my sister are the only people who find this funny. This is so niche that...
Yeah. I mean, I guess with Jamie, I mean, he's always been hilarious. So I guess he probably knew. But definitely, like, for people that you've never met to say, you know, this is a really funny show, I guess it must be very rewarding.
And particularly on a show that... I mean, I spoke to Jamie about it a little bit on here. I'd only watched a couple of episodes at that point. But a show that a lot of the jokes aren't there on paper.
They're
only there when he's performing it as that character. You know, it seems like a terrible line. But him saying it, that's the reason it's funny. Because it is a terrible line. And it's the kind of thing a cheesy guy would come up with.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been all the more rewarding to get that huge reaction. Because on paper, someone had to take the faith that it'll work when we film it. And then there's probably some doubt, as any project, that you filmed it, you're like, I think it's good. Is it good?
We enjoyed it, but did
we just enjoy it? So.
Yeah, I think, so rewarding to see that, like, the silly things that you do with your friends can be very funny to loads of people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how was Rovers to work on? Because I love David Earle, and I love Joe Wilkerson. Everyone involved in that was great. And what they did there... Similar to how Brett often writes, and you know the stuff he's been involved in with Gervais and stuff like that, they had ridiculousness and ludicrousness.
Yeah.
But there's the heart and warmth in
there
that genuinely catches you. And it's I think it's from pushing it so ridiculous that it makes those moments of warmth. And your character had a lot of those moments of warmth kind of thing. So it makes it hit all the more, I guess. Mm. If it was just, oh, this is a lovely comedy, isn't it cute? It doesn't
still
hit.
Quite
because
absurd.
You had... Or Joe and David's characters in particular just being absolute bellends. When you manage to flip that switch and go, no, this is human, remember that, it gets you. So
I loved it so much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's travesty that it's not come back.
Yeah, yeah, completely.
But yeah, definitely it was like the weirdest group of people in terms of the characters, I mean. But the weirdest group of people coming together, being extremely weird, but also still being such likeable characters and such a, like, believable and warm, like, set. And the whole thing, I think, was just, like, so comforting.
Yeah.
And yet it was not recommissioned.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, do you put much thought into who it's being made for when you're looking at projects? Because I think Sky have made some really good and bold comedy in recent years, but I don't know if it's the platform for really good and bold comedy.
I know,
it feels like if Rovers had been on BBC Three or on Four, it probably would have clicked in the right way and kept being made. But again, that's not to have a go at Sky. They're the ones who made it.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't have existed at all without them. But it does feel like an interesting one, that the platform is weirdly influential on how the art is received, I guess.
Yeah, I guess weird because Sky like has a slightly different tone anyway, but also because it's people paying for it, I think.
Yeah.
I would assume, this is not really based on any kind of fact, but I would assume that people who watch Sky are kind of like, I've paid for this, therefore I want some sort of high budget, cool, slick drama that you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah.
But I know that they did definitely.
But they can buy all of that off HBO. They do
that
wonderfully.
Yeah,
spend your money on
this
stuff. Yeah,
I know. But yeah, I guess it's hard to say who the target audience, because like when you're writing it, it's just for the people that you hope will love it.
And again, when you're writing it, particularly if you've had any projects that have got steam and then hit a wall or never got any steam, the fact that someone's fucking making it is all that's important.
Yeah.
You've got to have that belief that, right, it's just, we need to make it happen.
Yeah.
And then what happens after that happens after that, I guess.
And yeah, I definitely think it was kind of like a, I'm not sure if like culty is the right word, but there definitely were so many people who were like, I love Rovers when they're coming back. And even still now, people are like, is there a season two coming? And I'm like, I wish.
Well, there was another one they did around that time, and I can't remember the name of it, which is bad because a mate of mine wrote it. But it was about essentially a pirate radio station on a canal boat.
I know what you mean.
And that was a similar one that was just so warm and lovely. And
it's great cash as well.
Yeah, everyone involved in it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then it just seemed to kind of go, no. But again, they were two shows at the same time that kind of felt, if they had maybe been somewhere else, they might have.
Yeah. And that's a good thing about America, I guess. There's so many channels.
Yeah.
That, like, there's always going to be a home for something. Even if it's like, because, like, have you seen You on Netflix?
Yes.
So, like, that started off on Lifetime, which I think of as, like, a quite random, weird channel.
Completely.
And yet, it's still a huge success because it's, I mean, it's a great show. I love it so much.
I was
going to
say, what did you think of it? Because I was really, I loved the journey I went on with it, because there was so much where I was like, no, now this is crap, it's gone up its own arse. And then it switched and go, no, we know where we've gone.
Yeah, exactly.
We were doing an impression of a show that's gone up its own arse.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
God, are you really clever? Or am I, don't know what's going on here.
I think those people said to me that they were like, oh no, it's just really trashy. And I was like, I don't think it is trashy. I think it's like very knowing.
Yeah.
I think my friends think I'm stupid for saying that, but I'm like, there's just so many. When I first started watching it, I was like, this is gross, because the bit when she's like walking through in the very first episode and he's like, oh, like you're wearing this thing and that's why. And I was like, sorry. And then I realised that that's the whole point
of it. That's the point. Again, I think that's what was great about it, was it was parody in a lot of stuff, but having the boldness to not need to give the wink to go, you know, this is a joke, right? Which I think is a problem with a lot of modern media, is we feel the need to have everything explained and tied up. What's his name? Grille. There's a director I've been watching recently, Robert Grille something or something, Grillet. And one of his big things was film is a form of art, right? Mm-hmm. And you can go into a gallery and love a painting. Mm-hmm. You might not completely understand it. You might not even know what the subject of the painting is, but you love it. Mm-hmm. And film should be similar in that way. You can have stuff that you don't understand or isn't explained or isn't tied up. And maybe if you get the explanation, it'll make you love it more.
Yeah.
Or it might make you not like it anymore. But there's so much of a norm in modern film and TV to go, we need to make sure by the end everyone got that this was it, or this was a nod and a
this
wink.
This was our point. Yeah.
It's a mad one. So, I mean, thankfully, I wanted to make sure I got at least, you know, half hour, 40 minutes in before I got onto Taskmaster, because everyone knows, or a lot of people know, I'm quite obsessed with the show. I think it's the most consistent show on TV. So, so how was that to be part of? And you were on there with Hugh Dennis, Joe Lycett, Noel Fielding, and Mel Godrich, who, until I wrote her name down for this, I never realised that we don't talk enough about how weird that surname is. It's because she's
Melon Sue. Polish, it's just,
it's crazy surname. Yeah. But how was that to be part of? Because
it was so cool.
It just looks like it's not work, right?
It's definitely not work. Again, it's the nicest people. It just feels like going to school and like playing. Mm. Just the whole thing is, I came last. But I think I was mistreated by judges.
Yep.
I think my age let me down because they were jealous of my youth.
Yeah. And Hugh got let off with quite a bit because of being
the oldest
statesman.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. But it was so fun. And before I did it, I was like, I'm going to be so competitive. I'm definitely going to win. And then I got there and I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
It's such a weird one though as well, right? Because the big breakthrough in panel shows was the realization that no one actually cares who wins. It's about what's entertaining.
Yeah.
But I don't think I could accept that if I was on Tekkers, because it is exactly what you're meant to be there to be entertaining. And, and Bob Mortimer was the best of that in my opinion, just on his own in the series where he would just not care.
Do
tasks. I always remember there was one task where you've got, say, 5 minutes to make as big a mess as possible and then clear it all up. And Bob just trashed the whole house for 5 minutes and then didn't clear it up. So there you go, I've lost.
It was just
genius, because all the time you're thinking, or for a minute or two, you're thinking, how's he going to do? He's got something amazing planned to clear this up. Like, no, he's just not going to clear it up.
It's so funny to put your faith in comedians and think that they're going to
take it seriously. So at what point did you, or do you feel you made a conscious choice to abandon your competitiveness, or do you feel that as soon as you start to go, oh, I might not be doing great in this, maybe I'll just focus on being funny now? Or was there that?
I think I wasn't concerned about being funny at all, because I went into it thinking I'm going to be really competitive, because with puzzles and like riddles and stuff, I'm very competitive.
Yeah.
But with stuff like that, that's like, I mean, the magic of the show is that you can't really be good at it.
Yeah.
And I think I would just come into a task and I would read it and I would just be like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
It was very rarely that I'd be like, okay, I know what I'm doing. And I think actually that's less fun when you're like, I know what I'm doing. And there was even when I did well in tasks, it was very rare that I thought, okay, I think I've nailed that one. I thought that maybe once.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think being funny just goes out of the window. It's like the tasks themselves are so funny and you're going to make a fool of yourself no matter what.
Yeah. And that's the key, I think.
Yeah.
Throwing away any attempt at I'm going to be in control of
how I come across here. You absolutely can't.
I've done a few escape rooms now, and the first one of them I did, it was exactly the same. I was like, I'm really logical.
Exactly.
It's going to be great. I literally went in there. The first thing, I had no idea what to do. I was like, I guess that's it then. Thankfully, someone else got that. And when we got going, I flowed.
Yeah, I guess with other people it helps as well.
It annoyed the hell out of me. I was like, right, so what do we do? I was like,
you're
not going to tell us where to start? It's like, no, you just,
And I guess also the knowledge that like,
I'm defeated already.
Yeah, there's no right answer to it. Because normally with stuff like that, you're like, okay, well, there is a solution. And I should work out what it is. Whereas with Taskmaster, it's like, There's no solution.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably tasks that they tried out and then realised that they were either impossible or just, like, not as entertaining as they thought they would be.
Yeah.
And so they just scrapped them.
Yeah.
So, it's quite fun to know that anything you do is could be right.
Yeah. Did, were there any tasks that you did that don't make it to the show? Like, yeah. Backup tasks and stuff like that, that they select the best?
There was one, I'm not sure if it was in the show or not, but some of the tiebreaker tasks don't make it in.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I should say this, but
fine.
I'm sure that'd be fine. But there was one where we had to sit on like an umpire's chair.
Yeah.
And there was a wine bottle, an empty wine bottle at the bottom of the chair, and we had a full wine bottle.
Right.
And we had to try and pour as much wine into the bottle on the floor.
That's wonderful.
Which was great. And I think I got like a centimetre of wine. Because you have like 30 seconds to do it or something. Yeah. But I don't think that was in it.
Yeah.
But I think there also, I can't remember, but I think there definitely were tasks that didn't make it in. Because I guess just like either everyone did the same thing or like... They just weren't as entertaining as they were read on paper.
It's a beautiful one because it's a rare gig or booking to get where the main focus is you just going and enjoying it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And not really, I don't know how it turns out. We'll figure out that later. It's like, I've gone and enjoyed it. I've done my bit. Oh, is it aired now?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, yeah.
I hope that went well, guys.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So, so what was your route into comedy and, I mean, into entertainment in general? Growing up, did you grow up in London?
Yeah.
Exactly. So growing up, were you always looking to entertain and do comedy or performance? Or what was your...
When I was younger, I wanted to be an actress.
Yep.
But didn't really know how you became an actress.
Yeah.
I wanted to do drama at university. My parents were like, no, you have to do a proper subject. So I did English at university, but did lots of like drama-y stuff while I was there.
It's a good route because there's going to be some offshoots that are kind of drama-y or
similar,
play
or
theatre or whatever.
So did lots of stuff and then did some sketches while I was at uni and then went to Edinburgh, went to the Fringe in the summers and sort of like watched lots of stuff.
Yeah.
So I knew that I wanted to do comedy acting, but I didn't really know how. And then when I graduated from university, I applied to drama school, but didn't get into Lambda, which was the only place I wanted to go. I don't really know why. I just settled on Lambda for no real reason.
That's the one I want to go to.
Yeah, yeah. And then got into a different one and was like, no, I didn't get into Lambda, so I'm not going.
Oh, wow.
And then just started doing open mic gigs and... going to Edinburgh and doing gigs while I was there. And I interned at the Invisible Dot.
Oh, right.
So, like, met lots of comedians and, like, learnt a lot about comedy and a lot about... watched lots of stuff and learnt about performing that way, I suppose.
It's a perfect way to immerse yourself in it all, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, what better way to learn? Like, you hear of a fair amount of comedians in America who were dormant at the Comedy Store or things like that were there for so long that then go, all right, I've figured out what my voice will be.
Because
I think when you start off, you're so influenced by your influences.
Because
they're what you're obsessed with.
Oh, my God,
having that ability to see a whole range of other things, rather than will give you more influences, will give you a greater ability to find yourself.
Yeah.
Rather than go, well, I love this person, I'm going to be my version.
Yeah. I think I probably did both, though.
Yeah.
Because the other day I got an email from Dropbox being like, you have to sign in, otherwise we're going to like delete your account.
Yeah.
And then I signed in and I saw a video of my first ever gig.
Oh, wow.
And I watched it and I was like, you're just trying to be Nick Mohammed.
Wow.
Because he was the person I loved the most. And he was the person I saw in Edinburgh and was like, oh, that's what I want to do. Because I knew that stand-up existed and I knew that I didn't really want to do stand-up because I was too nervous to do stand-up.
Right.
And I saw him doing character stand-up essentially and was like, I didn't even know that was a thing. And then, watched the
video. So, was he doing multiple characters or one character?
He was doing multiple characters. Yeah. He was mostly doing Mr. Swallow, but he was doing different ones. And then, I watched this video the other day and just all my mannerisms and everything was just ripped off of him.
Oh, wow.
But I think, like, slowly, after I stopped doing that specific character, I started to, like, find my own voice.
Yeah.
But definitely, a mixture of, like, watching people and being like, oh, that's what you can do. That's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
That is what I want to do. And then.
And at what point did you, or are you yet to, get kind of the acceptance from your family on that? You said they weren't that keen on you going to drama school or whatever. Again, it's so typical London, or like my family are all South London, and it's very much, I remember the year I did The Fringe, I was doing a show every night, and I wrote a big chunk of a novel in the daytime while I was up there, because in my head I couldn't justify that my day's work was 1 hour
yeah,
a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reality is, it's exhausting, and you're doing it, and it's draining.
It's hard to explain, but it is.
I'm up here for a month. I can't be doing an hour a day.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just forcing myself to do all this other stuff because of that kind of South London working class.
Yeah, yeah.
Get a real job type.
Yeah, exactly.
Influence.
I think when I worked at like a normal boring office job.
Yeah.
And then the year that I wanted to go to Edinburgh to do like maybe like to split an hour with someone or like do a very like early work in progress of a show, I asked them if I could take a month off.
Yeah.
And then come back. 'Cause I was sort of part-time, sort of not really part-time.
Yeah.
Well, I said, can I work from home? And then thinking that I could sort of do part-time, and then they were like, yeah, you can work from home, but you'd have to work from home like 8 till 4 or whatever it was, and that I already didn't like the job anymore, so I was like, okay, this is a great reason to quit my job.
Yeah, I'm leaving now.
Yeah, so I left and moved out of my flat that I could, so I could, because I couldn't live there anymore.
Yeah.
And moved back in with my parents, and I think at that point they were like, sorry, this job that you want to do means that you have to quit your job and move back in with your parents.
This isn't the direction it was meant
to exactly
be going
you had a job and you moved out and everything was going well. And so I think at that point they were like, this is not what we thought. And then and I did my first Edinburgh, and then after that things started to go better, and they were like, okay, maybe you did actually make the right decision.
It's a massive move and commitment on your part to take that, because again, it would have felt like a step backwards in many ways to go, right, because a lot of people, the reason they will give for not chasing their dream or whatever is, I've got a mortgage, I've got this, I've got that. So to go, right, that's not a good enough excuse. Mm-hmm. I'll get rid of the rent I have to pay or whatever, and I'll go back. And again, obviously, I'm not saying that everyone has the option of returning home or whatever else, but it's a big step. So what had you had certain experiences that gave you the confidence, or was it just you knew that you wanted to know you'd given your all to that?
I think I just knew that if I wanted to be a comedian, I would have to do Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And I also didn't like my job.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, either I carry on with this job and never do Edinburgh properly, or I just try it, and then maybe if it doesn't work out, then I can get another job afterwards.
Yeah.
But I also, I think it was the year that John Kearns won Best Newcomer.
Right.
And in his speech he said, or I think maybe like just after that he quit his job, and I remember thinking like, I've quit my job, I haven't even started doing comedy yet.
Yeah.
What am I thinking?
It's great though. I was doing an interview, honestly, a few years back, and it was only then that I realised, because I've told the story loads of times, that I quit my job to go and tour the country just doing music. I was living in a van, just doing it on street corners or whatever else. And it wasn't until I was doing an interview recently that I realised I'd never actually performed in front of anyone at that point. I'd practiced it all. I knew I'd got it good in my head.
Yeah,
I was like,
here's
what I'm going to go and do.
Yeah.
But it was after I'd quit that. So it's like that, almost that lack of overthinking was what allowed it. And it's a similar thing there. If you're looking there at the person who's just won the newcomer and they've just quit their job, and you're like, you've just quit your job. So what am I doing here? How did this happen? That must have been exciting and intimidating.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when those gambles pay off, it's a great story.
Yeah, exactly.
If they don't, it's not such a great story. It's slightly awkward. So so how was the Fringe for you? Because it is, or that first time as a performer, I guess, because it's something that people moan sometimes on the podcast, is anytime the Fringe comes up, I will talk about it for hours, because it blows me away. The fact it's such a uniquely UK, Scottish, British or whatever thing, because they don't have it in America, and they don't have it in so many places. And you can go up there for a month and spend all day being inspired by theatre, by comedy, by spoken word, by so many things. And it's you're there feeling as if everyone's on a level and anyone can do this.
Yeah,
it's one of
those
gigs where you're not standing there thinking it's completely out of reach. You're standing there thinking, I could be that. I couldn't be exactly that, or I couldn't be that yet, but I could be that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's like, it's very close to us. It's not like this thing that we have to break.
No.
It's just, it's open to anyone.
Yeah.
And anyone
can
get up.
And you can get as inspired by the not so good shows.
Yeah, totally. Go, well, yeah.
I not arrogantly, I could do that. I could do better than that.
Yeah.
You give me half hour.
Yeah, there's a million things all the time that you can be inspired by.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's like 4 hours away on the train. I think it's the best thing in the world. That's like the one thing I don't like so much about acting is that it takes me away from doing The Fringe, because it's kind of like you kind of have to decide in February that you're going to do The Fringe, or even earlier than that, and then it kind of takes up your year.
The worst thing about acting is how last minute it is, and how you drop everything.
Exactly.
For it. I regularly have kind of a known shorthand or saying with my family now was that when they say, "Oh, we've got this thing in August," my response is always, "I hope I can't make it."
Yeah.
Because my plan is to be acting somewhere and to be doing something. I've not got it in at the moment. Genuinely, with all the greatest respect, I hope I'm too busy because I'm aiming to be somewhere else. But if I'm about, I'd love to.
Honour.
But so, who were your kind of peers at that time? Who were you coming up with or starting out with? And
I think I was like slightly later than most of the people who I now think of as my peers. Because I flyered One Edinburgh for Sheeps, and then because I was a huge fan of Sheeps.
Right.
And now maybe slightly arrogantly think of Sheeps as my peers.
Yeah.
But kind of like Sheeps, Ellie White, Emma Siddy, all the people in Bear Pits are like Adam Hess, Matt Ewins, Finn Taylor. And then people like Lazy Susan, Massive Dad, Birthday Girls. Although Birthday Girls, I think, maybe slightly, because they were Lady Garden before, so maybe slightly older than me. Yeah, and like John Poynting and all these like great, cool people.
I love John. I called John a 1 year purely because I really liked his character in that advert. Vampire. I was like, that's hilarious. I'm not swayed by advertising, but that character, I would watch a series of that vampire.
So I saw it in Waterloo Station, like in a massive screen, and I was like, that's what's very funny.
And then I went and watched his show, and it's completely different, but absolutely amazing. And he was playing kind of an acting teacher as that thing. And it was so perfect for everything I was kind of contemplating within myself at that point, of thinking of myself as this or not this. So, amazing. But was that kind of around the first kind of times that there was almost a pressure on building a social media following to then support your comedy career? The one that made it come to mind was Adam Hess, because I loved his tweets for years, and then I caught him at The Fringe and he was wonderful, but I got into him because of that. So a few years before that, there wasn't really that pressure. It was you get on a TV show, or you get, you know, any other way. It seemed to be around that time that it started to be, well, there's a lot that you can do that for yourself here, but you've got to be putting in the
I started off like writing funny tweets just because, like, I thought that Twitter was fun and I liked the funny jokes that were on Twitter. And that's how I met Adam Hess, actually. We made friends on Twitter first.
He's great on Twitter. If you're not following him on Twitter, he's so wonderful.
Funny. I sort of started out, like, writing little jokes on Twitter. I think that was, like, when I was at university. And then when I started doing gigs, I would, like, pinch from the stuff that I'd written as tweets. So it sort of started out as, this is just going to be my output for jokes. And then it sort of morphed into, if you want to come and see me, this is where I'm doing gigs, so please come and see me if you like these jokes that I've done.
Yeah.
And then now I think it's probably like a mixture of the two.
It's got to be tough sometimes, all right, because if you're writing a tweet and you think, this is really good, this is a bit. I can't throw this away on a tweet because I need to make it into something more. Is there any feeling of that it's disposable if it's there, but
I think sometimes, I used to think that, and then now I'm like, just get it down, and then at least it's there, rather than it sort of being in the ether as a bit.
I think that's key on all writing, right? Because it's having the confidence that you're going to continue to write good stuff. There's a pressure of, I've had this one idea, this is the idea that has to make it. Write it, and hopefully it'll work, but you'll make other stuff.
Exactly.
You can't hold things back, because you're like, well, this isn't the project yet.
Or,
you know, so it's it's an interesting one. So at what point, I'll start to wrap things up as we've gone over the hour mark. At what point did you then, obviously stand-up started to go well, at what point did you start going into acting? Because you said that was your kind of original goal. Your original goal was, I wanted to be an actor. Mm-hmm. Now the stand-up's going well and you get to realise that goal, but then have the conflict of, I want to still call myself a stand-up, so I need to have that balance.
Yeah, I think because I got an agent after I did a few gigs in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, because there are a lot of comedians making shows as well.
Yeah.
I then started to audition for, like, sitcoms that comedians were making. Of course. The first thing I did was Josh Widdicombe's sitcom.
Yes.
So I think that was sort of like the branch into acting. It was like, I can do basically what I do on stage and do like my characters in a TV show.
Yeah.
And then from that start to do like acting.
It literally helps everyone because if they're writing and they need characters and they go, well, I like Lolly's character.
Yeah, yeah.
As a I can put that in.
And
then you can even put a bit in or anything like that. It's easy to kind of go, well, that kind of writes itself because I've not got to come up with this character.
Mm-hmm.
You're casting as you're writing as such.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's got to be handy to be in. And again, I think we're getting more and more of that with a lot more of the digital kind of age. And I think Dave are responsible as well, but a lot more where people are doing exactly that. They're saying, I believe in this comedian.
Yeah, yeah.
Go and create.
Yeah, the world that you want to make.
Or Josh or any of these things. Go and make it and then we'll back that as such. So before I wrap things up, have you been on a wine tasting course yet? Because I enjoyed Off the Menu podcast and you were saying you need to go on one at some point.
Not yet, it's my plan for the next couple of months. I need to do one.
And how do you find... It's interesting because I think... I was discussing this before you came in. I get pitched a lot of guests on the podcast that are on Press Junkets. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky on that because I can say I need an hour. But I think I will get them because that's a podcast you don't have to prepare for.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Off Menu and you're on the live Films to Be Buried with Brett Goldstein, they're the podcasts where you have to prepare. It's a tough balance.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, between just turn up and I'll talk and it'll be fine. So here's your homework. See you next week. And and again, your decisions are locked down. People were furious about some of your McDonald's choices.
And someone...
I was angry about the chips thing. I don't think McDonald's chips are close
the best chips.
I think it was Burger King. James who was saying Burger King.
Yeah, and I don't think I eat Burger King enough. That's why.
I think... Because Ed was on your side, it got dismissed almost instantly. I was like, that deserved at least more of a fight.
I believed him. I believed him that was probably the case. But I think that McDonald's is so ingrained within me that the food itself, not counting the chips, is what I go there for.
You see, I was so pleased with your episode because I think on... Because so for anyone who doesn't know, Off Menu is you get to create your perfect meals. So you choose the best starter you've ever had, the best main and all these kind of things. And I think that so often when people go on anything like that, they fucking lie. And they go with the cool, obscure thing that they've had in some place. And on mine, I think all of the things on my meal, someone joked, you could have delivered to your door. And that was, I was like, well, that's the kind of, I've eaten in some nice places as well. I'm not.
Who doesn't like having food delivered to their door?
Exactly. So I was pleased that a lot of yours were like, no, here's the best Chinese I used to go to, or takeaway place, or Burger King, or McDonald's, or whatever else.
Because
that's the reality.
Yeah. That's what people love. That's why they're successful companies.
It's why everyone always on... when everyone has their last meal question. And again, Pizza Hut came up a lot in my Off Menu.
Mm-hmm.
It would probably be my choice as a last meal because I wouldn't eat it so much if I didn't really like
it. Exactly, yeah. I haven't had Pizza Hut in ages, but I know I love it.
Yeah, it's like, why would you choose as your last meal? Something you hardly ever eat anyway.
Yeah.
If you liked it so much, you'd eat it more often. Let's be real about it. So are you a big... film fan as well? I just want to kind of I'm getting pre-information for Films to Be Buried with here.
I'm not a film fan, but I get very distracted very easily, so I don't watch films as much as I watch TV. But the films I do watch, love them.
You a cinema goer or more of
not as much as I should be? So I live in
Because I think that's key often for not being distracted, because it is, it's just it's a dark room and the focus is there
and you can't pause it.
I'm a massive film fan, but it annoys me that I can't. I struggle to focus at home. I'll be having a quick check on my phone or whatever else. Whereas in the cinema, I'll behave myself.
Yeah, I definitely need to go to the cinema more.
Yeah.
But there's always too many films to see, I think, and then I just end up not seeing any of them.
It's. I mean, the art of it all is making. I genuinely think is the beauty of the world that we live in now, and the fact that you can go from comedy to to acting and back and forth and not have to say, here's the one that I do, mm-hmm. is that you can make your passions your work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
as soon as I started doing an end of the year films list and things mm-hmm. like that, it means I see a fuckload of films every year because I see it as work. I get to go, well, you know, I've kind of got to watch that. It's my responsibility to my fans.
So it's the kind people of will riot if you
Yeah, exactly. Or equally, I can now go that I dig myself out. I'm kind of a workaholic and I'm bad at resting. I dig myself out if I've taken a day to watch tons of TV or films. Mm-hmm. And I'd enjoy it, but in the back of my head, I'd be going, you're not being productive. Mm-hmm. But now I'm acting. It's all research.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all going, oh, that's an amazing story. That's an amazing character. Exactly, it's tax deductible. The best, I'll end this now on the best tax deductible thing I found was going to Millie's Cookies and get one of them giant cookie cakes. And when they asked what to ice on it, I got them to ice the name of my record label.
Amazing.
Literally, as soon as I Instagram it makes it tax deductible.
Yeah,
it's been a promo thing. I just fancied a giant cookie cake when it wasn't my birthday.
Yeah.
Well,
that's so good.
I'll wrap things up there. Thank you very much for your time. And just basically, what's ahead? Do you kind of know, are there any roles that you've got that you can talk about? Is there stuff that you get to do the cool actor thing of saying, well, I can't really talk about it right now.
Yeah,
but.
Well, I don't know. Nobody ever tells me whether I can say stuff or not, and I've got into trouble before.
I always edge on the side of not just because I'm so new to it. I'm like, I don't want to be the one that fucks things up.
Yeah. Okay, I'll be very vague.
Brilliant.
And I'll say two or one BBC One show that comes out in a few months. And one, I think, actually maybe two BBC One shows coming out. Two BBC One comedies.
That's
coming
great.
Out soon. Yeah.
And then have you got any desire to write your own for TV or film?
Yeah, I'm sort of slowly like trying to work out what I want to do.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm
it's
not
kind
necessarily...
of the crossover over the two, right?
Yeah,
it's taking what you
stuff
love about
you've
stand-up
made,
and what you love about... acting and kind of slinging them together.
Yeah, I think it's good as well to do lots of acting first.
Yeah.
And see just what works and what you like.
Yeah.
And see
and
like
get to read a load of scripts.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
absolutely the key, right?
Yeah, and see like a
good.
Script to screen like how it works and like what works the best.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of slowly trying to like pull some stuff together and be like, okay, now I'm very happy with this, rather than just straight away being like, you want to make something with me? Okay, let me quickly think of an idea and then it not be exactly what I want to make.
Exactly that. I love that. Well, thank you very much for your time and I look forward to all that is ahead.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pips Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Lolly. I told you it was a joy, did I not? A wonderful one. If you're new to the podcast, you know, I should recommend some previous comedians I've had on, maybe, as Lolly obviously is smashing it as an actress, but is a comedian by trade. I'm scrolling through and instantly has jumped out, a Michaela Cole, just as another British actress that's killing it in the comedy areas as well. I've had Michaela on twice. But previous guests, you might fancy Dan Skinner. You might know I want to have a listen to. He's a funny guy. I've had Simon Pegg on a load of times. Jamie Demetriou. I think we talk about Jamie in this episode. We do. Yeah, we did. Obviously, I recalled these outros a little bit after the actual thing. Jamali Maddox is a great comedian and pal of mine. Steve McNeil. Oh, in fact, I should mention, I'm doing Steve McNeil's... Hang on, when's this podcast coming out? The 20th. No, I would have done it last night. I would have done Steve McNeil's live gaming show, comedy and gaming show last night. But I've mentioned it too late. Comedians to mention, Chris Ramsey, Gus Kahn has been on. Who else? Amanda Iannucci, Ashlyn B, Sophie Hagen, Alice Lowe. Who else? I'm just going to list all the comedians I've had on and then I'll miss some and someone will be offended. Susan Wacoma, comedy actress. Catherine Ryan was on. That was right. She was fantastic. I got to meet her dogs.
That was ace. Who else? I've had loads of comedians. I've had Ian Lee. I've had Frankie Boyle. I've had Limmy, Marcus Brigstock, Brendan Burns. They're all flooding back now. James Acaster, Tom Rosenthal, Brian Gittins and Joe Wilkinson, Izzy Sooty. Who else? The Rubber Bandits, Blind Boy specifically. Robin Ince. And obviously I can't mention Robin Ince without mentioning Josie Long. Other comedians, Brett Goldstein, that came up in conversation in this podcast, he was on. Tom Davis, I think we also talked about Tom, he's been on. Yeah, tons. I think that's a long enough a list for you all. I've got some more comedians to come. I'm recording with some comedians this next week or two, so that's something to look forward to. Yeah, all right, I'm going to go. I'll see you all. I didn't mention Adam Buxton. I had Adam Buxton on, Joe Cornish. Loads of good people, mate. Don't you worry about that. Oh, I'm clearly a bit feverish and delirious. I wonder how long this outro is going to end up being. It's not been that long so far. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will be back next week. Feel free to follow me on socials if you don't already, and give me a shout. You know, it makes a difference when you tweet and scream and shout about episodes. It's easy to get in the habit of just listening every week and not vocalizing anything about it, so it's good. It really helps word of mouth. Obviously, before the Pod Bible came about, word of mouth was the only way to get podcasts out there. Now we've got the Pod Bible, so go and check that out. podbiblemag.com. You can read it for free, you can download it for free, and go on the socials where we'll be recommending tons of stuff. So yeah, that's all that. I'm gonna go and feel ill. I might get takeaway. See you later. I'll see you next week. When, let's tell you, I've got next week, I've got Stephen Merchant. Yeah, I hadn't even announced that, but people are very excited about. You know, he's a podcast legend. We had a good old chat. I sat in his new living room, or his new spare room, kind of, let's call it a study. So that's next week. Just drop that fact on you out of nowhere to get you crazy excited. You're welcome. I'll talk to you soon. Ta-ta!
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.